Welcome to 2025 and the audio recordings of the Adult Sabbath School lesson for the first quarter. These readings are provided by Christian Services for the Blind, based at Adventist Media in Sydney, Australia. We thank Dr. Percy Harold and other guest readers for volunteering their time.
Yes, thanks for listening to the reading of lesson number 10 from the series God's Love and Justice. This week's lesson is titled Rules of Engagement and is ready for teaching on Sabbath, March 8. The author is Dr. John C. Peckham of the Adventist Review and Adventist World, and your reader today will be Pastor Roger Vince. But before that, we have the memory text with Minnie Evans.
My name is Minnie Evans. I currently go to New Life Church and I'm a design student. 1 John 3 verse 8 says, "He who sins is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. For this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil."
Lesson 10, to be studied for March 8, Sabbath afternoon. Memory text: "He who sins is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. For this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil." 1 John 3 and verse 8. A powerful narrative that reveals the nature of the cosmic conflict can be found in 1 Kings 18 verses 19 to 40, the story of Elijah on Mount Carmel, where the Lord exposes the so-called gods of the nations. Yet there is more behind these gods than that they are merely the figments of pagan imagination. Behind the gods that the nations surrounding Israel thought they were worshipping was actually something else. Deuteronomy 32 and verse 17 says, "They sacrificed to demons, not to God, to gods they did not know, to new gods, new arrivals that your fathers did not fear." Paul adds in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 20, "The things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to have fellowship with demons." Behind the false gods of the nation, then, were demons in disguise. This means that all of the texts of Scripture dealing with idolatry and the foreign gods are actually cosmic conflict texts. With this background, the cosmic conflict theme is better understood. And this truth has massive implications for understanding more about the nature of this conflict and how it sheds light on the problem of evil. Sunday, March 2, an angel delayed. As we have seen, the false gods of the nations were actually demons in disguise. And elsewhere, we see evidence that demonic celestial rulers are sometimes behind earthly rulers. Even angelic agents sent by God can be opposed by the forces of the enemy. Read Daniel 10, verses 1 to 14, with special attention to verses 12 and 13. What do these verses teach that is relevant to the cosmic conflict? And what do you make of the angel sent by God being withstood for 21 days? Daniel 10, verses 1 to 14. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a revelation was given to Daniel, who was called Belteshazzar. Its message was true, and it concerned a great war. The understanding of the message came to him in a vision. "At that time, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. I ate no choice food, no meat or wine touched my lips, and I used no lotions at all until the 3 weeks were over. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris, I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen, with a belt of fine gold from Uphaz around his waist. His body was like topaz, his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice like the sound of a multitude. I, Daniel, was the only one who saw this vision. Those who were with me did not see it, but such a terror overwhelmed them that they fled and hid themselves. So I was left alone, gazing at this great vision. But I had no strength left. My face turned deathly pale, and I was helpless. Then I heard him speaking, and I listened to him, and fell into a deep sleep, my face to the ground. A hand touched me, and set me trembling on my hands and knees. He said, "Daniel, you who are highly esteemed, consider carefully the words I am about to speak to you, and stand up, for I have now been sent to you." And when he said this to me, I stood up, trembling. Then he continued, "Do not be afraid, Daniel. Since the first day that you set your mind to gain understanding and to humble yourself before God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to them. But the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me 21 days. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me because I was detained there with the king of Persia. Now I have come to explain to you what will happen to your people in the future, for the vision concerns a time yet to come." How could it be that an angel sent by God could be withstood for 3 weeks? Being all-powerful, God possessed the power to respond to Daniel immediately, that is, had he chosen to. If he exercised his power to do so, he could make an angel appear to Daniel right away. And yet, the angel sent by God was withstood by the prince of the kingdom of Persia for 3 entire weeks. What is going on here? Ellen G. White in Prophets and Kings makes the following comment. "For 3 weeks, Gabriel wrestled with the powers of darkness, seeking to counteract the influences at work on the mind of Cyrus. All that heaven could do in behalf of the people of God was done. The victory was finally gained, and the forces of the enemy were held in check all the days of Cyrus and all the days of his son Cambyses." Prophets and Kings, page 572. In order for such a conflict to transpire, God must not be exercising all his power. The enemy must be afforded some genuine freedom and power that is not removed capriciously, but is restricted by some parameters known to both parties, the details of which are not revealed to us. It seems there must be parameters in the cosmic conflict that even God's angels are operating within, which, in the coming lessons, will be referred to as the rules of engagement. In a certain sense, understanding these limits might not be hard if we grasp the idea, already talked about, that God works only by love, and that love, not coercion, is the foundation of his government. This idea, that God works only through the principles emanating from love, can help us better understand the great controversy. And thought for reflection. How have you experienced the limits of working only through the principles of love and not coercion? What lessons did you learn about the limits of power? Monday, March 3, The Dragon of Revelation. The overarching perspective of celestial rulers in the cosmic conflict is encapsulated in the book of Revelation, where the devil is depicted as the great dragon who opposes God and deceives the whole world. Revelation 12, verse 9. Read Revelation 13, verses 1 to 8. What does this reveal about the extent of the dragon's jurisdiction? Revelation 13. The dragon stood on the shore of the sea. and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on its horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear, and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power, and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. And the whole world was filled with wonder and followed the beast. People worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast, and they also worshipped the beast and asked, "Who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it?" The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise its authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. It was given power to wage war against God's holy people and to conquer them. And it was given authority over every tribe, people, language and nation. All inhabitants of the world will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, the Lamb who was slain from the foundation of the world. The dragon, Satan, not only wars against God and his servants, but he is depicted as the ruler behind the earthly kingdoms who persecute God's people throughout the ages. The dragon gave his power, his throne, and his great authority to the beast from the sea. This beast from the sea is given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. So, Satan, the dragon, gives power and ruling authority to the beast, an earthly religious political power. This power is exercised in order to usurp the worship that is due alone to God. The beast blasphemes God's name. It also wars against and even overcomes God's holy ones, his saints, at least for a period of time. This worldwide authority and jurisdiction is given to him by the dragon, the usurping ruler of this world. And yet, there are clear limits on Satan and his agencies, including temporal limits. Revelation 12 and verse 12 says, "Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time." Satan knows that his time is short, and the events described in Revelation proceed along prophetic timelines, which show specific limits to the reign of these evil forces. Indeed, God finally triumphs. Revelation 21 verse 4 says, "And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away." Thought for reflection. However hard it might be for us to see it now, in the end, good will eternally triumph over evil. Why is it so important that we never forget this wonderful promise? Tuesday, March 4, the case of Job. In the book of Job, we are given some fascinating insights into the reality of the great controversy. Read Job 1, verses 1 to 12, and Job 2, verses 1 to 7. And what principles of the great controversy do we see unveiled here? Job chapter 1. "In the land of Uz there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and he shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys. And he had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You've blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now, stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your power. But on the man himself, do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Chapter 2. On another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them to present himself before him. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright. He's a man who fears God and who shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." "Skin for skin," Satan replied. "A man will give all he has for his own life. But now stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head. Many significant details can be gleaned from these verses. First, there appears to be some kind of heavenly council scene, not merely a dialogue between God and Satan. Other celestial beings are involved. Second, there is some existing dispute, signaled by the fact that God asks whether Satan has it considered Job. Considered Job for what? The question makes sense in the context of a larger, ongoing dispute. Third, while God declares Job blameless, upright, and God-fearing, Satan claims that Job appears to fear God only because God protects him. This amounts to slander, both against Job's character and God's. Fourth, Satan alleges that God's protection of Job, that is the hedge, is unfair and makes it impossible for Satan to prove his allegations. This indicates some existing limits on Satan, that is, rules of engagement, and that Satan has apparently tried to harm Job. God responds to Satan's accusation before the heavenly council by allowing Satan to put his theory to the test, but only within limits. He first grants Satan power over all that he has, but prohibits personal harm to Job. Later, after Satan claims that Job cares only about himself, God allows Satan to afflict Job personally, but Satan must spare his life. Satan brings numerous calamities against Job's household, yet in each case, Job continues to bless his name, thereby falsifying Satan's charges. We may learn many things here, such as that there are rules of engagement in this cosmic conflict. There are parameters in the heavenly court within which the allegations raised against God can be settled, but without God violating the sacred principles inherent in love, which is the foundation of God's government and how he rules the universe and the intelligent beings in it. These heavenly scenes in the book of Job offer us a fascinating insight into the reality of the great controversy and how it is being played out here on earth. Wednesday, March 5, the temporary ruler of this world. We have seen in previous lessons that within the cosmic conflict, Satan and his cohorts are temporarily granted significant jurisdiction in this world, limited according to some kind of rules of engagement. These rules of engagement limit not only the actions of the enemy, the devil and his cohorts, they also limit God's action to eliminate or mitigate the evil that temporarily falls within the jurisdiction of the enemy. Because the Lord will never break his promises, to the extent he has agreed to the rules of engagement, thus affording some limited and temporary rulership to the devil, God has morally limited his future course of action without lessening his raw power. Read John 12, verse 31, John 14, verse 30, John 16, verse 11, 2 Corinthians 4, verse 4, and Luke 4, verse 6. What do these texts teach us about the rulership of the enemy in this world? John chapter 12 and verse 31. Now is the time for judgment on this world. Now the prince of this world will be driven out. John chapter 14 verse 30. I will not say much more to you, for the prince of this world is coming. He has no hold over me. John chapter 16 verse 11, concerning judgment as well, because the prince of this world now stands condemned. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4, the God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel that displays the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. In Luke 4 and verse 6, and he said to him, I will give you all their authority and splendor. It has been given to me, and I can give it to anyone I want to. The New Testament sets forth a clash of kingdoms, the kingdoms of light and darkness, with the darkness coming from Satan and his rebellion. Part of Christ's mission was to defeat the kingdom of Satan, as 1 John 3 and verse 8 tells us, for this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. Nevertheless, there are rules that limit what God can do while remaining true to the principles behind his government. These limits include, at least, 1, the granting of free will to creatures, and 2, the covenantal rules of engagement, which we are not privy to, at least now. Such impediments and limitations on divine action have significant implications for God's moral ability to reduce and or immediately eliminate evil in this world. And so we see continued evil and suffering, which can indeed cause many people to question either God's existence or his goodness. However, once the background of the great controversy is understood and the limits God has placed on how he will deal with evil, we can to some degree better understand why things are as they are, at least until the final triumph of God over evil. Question for reflection. How does the fact that Jesus calls Satan the ruler of this world help, at least somewhat, our understanding of the evil that exists in the world now? How comforting to know that it is, indeed, only a temporal rule. Thursday, March 6. Limits and Rules. The cosmic conflict is primarily a dispute over God's character, caused by the devil's slanderous allegations against God's goodness, justice, and government. It's a kind of cosmic covenant lawsuit. Such a conflict cannot be settled by sheer power, but instead requires demonstration. If serious allegations are brought against a person in power, the best and maybe the only way to defeat the allegations would be to allow for a free, fair, and open investigation. If the allegations threaten the entire government of love, they cannot simply be swept under the rug. What does all this mean for understanding the cosmic conflict and relating to the problem of evil? If God makes a promise, would he ever break it? Of course not. Insofar as God agrees to rules of engagement, his future action would be morally limited. And as such, some evils may fall within the temporary domain of the kingdom of darkness. Read Mark 6 verse 5 and Mark 9 verse 29. What do these texts display about how even divine action might be integrally related to such factors as faith and prayer? Mark 6 verse 5 says that Jesus could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. And in Mark 9 verse 29, Jesus replied, "This kind can come out only by prayer." In both these narratives, some limits or rules of engagement seem to be in place, dynamically related to such things as faith and prayer. Elsewhere, we see abundant evidence that prayer makes a difference in this world, opening up avenues for divine action that otherwise might not be morally available. However, we should not make the mistake of thinking that faith and prayer are the only factors. There are likely many other factors of which we might be unaware. This fits with what we've previously seen about rules of engagement. Insofar as God makes some commitment or agrees to some rules of engagement, as we said, there are some certain rules of engagement in the great controversy that limit what God can morally do, but at least for now. Thought for reflection. Read Romans 8 verse 18 and Revelation 21, 3 and 4, and ask how these texts give me confidence that even though there are many things that we do not understand, we can trust that God knows what is best, that he wants what is best, and that he will bring about an end to evil and usher in an eternity of bliss. Romans 8 verse 18 says, "I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us." And then Revelation 21, 3 and 4, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." Friday, March 7. Further thought. Read Ellen G. White, The Power of Satan, pages 341 to 47 in Testimonies for the Church, Volume 1. Fallen man is Satan's lawful captive. The mission of Christ was to rescue him from the power of his great adversary. Man is naturally inclined to follow Satan's suggestions, and he cannot successfully resist so terrible a foe unless Christ, the mighty conqueror, dwells in him, guiding his desires and giving him strength. God alone can limit the power of Satan. He is going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it. He's not off his watch for a single moment through fear of losing an opportunity to destroy souls. It is important that God's people understand this, that they may escape his snares. Satan is preparing his deceptions so that in his last campaign against the people of God, they may not understand that it is he. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 14 says, "And no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light." While some deceived souls are advocating he does not exist, he is taking them captive and is working through them to a great extent. Satan knows better than God's people the power that they can have over him when their strength is in Christ. When they humbly entreat the mighty conqueror for help, the weakest believer in the truth, firmly relying upon Christ, can successfully repulse Satan and all his host. He is too cunning to come out boldly, openly with his temptations, for then the drowsy energies of the Christian would arouse, and he would rely upon the strong and the mighty deliverer. But he comes in unperceived and works in disguise through the children of disobedience who profess godliness. Ellen White, Testimonies for the Church, Volume 1, page 341. Discussion questions. Question 1. What does it mean to be Satan's lawful captive? Does that mean that the devil can do whatever he wants with people? If not, why not? How does this relate to what we might call the rules of engagement in the cosmic conflict? Question 2. Why would God grant Satan any jurisdiction in the cosmic conflict, even if only temporarily? What does this tell us about how God seeks to answer Satan's accusations? And 3. How do you respond to those, even Christians, who deny the existence of Satan as a real personal being? Though we cannot prove Satan's existence, what evidence can you marshal that might help someone who is so greatly deceived?
The Persistent Visitor, Part 2, by Andrew McChesney. To the Seventh-day Adventist pediatrician, the 13-year-old Alaskan native girl resembled a giant. 4 months after their first call, pediatrician Colette Real made the 7-hour drive from Anchorage to Fairbanks, Alaska, to meet Matrona for the first time at the facility where she lived, with 19 other girls and boys. Matrona stood at 5 foot 7 inches, which is 174 centimeters. In comparison, Colette was a diminutive 5 foot 3 inches, which is 162 centimeters. When Colette saw the girl, she thought, "She looks like a giant to me. This should be interesting." Matrona, who was sitting on the floor in a meeting room, was very shy and didn't want to talk at first. Colette sat down on a couch near her. A few awkward minutes passed, and then she remembered that she had brought a gift, an encyclopedia about animals for Matrona. Colette opened the book and silently began to leaf through the pages. Matrona's curiosity was raised, and she slowly inched her way over to Colette. Before long, Matrona was sitting beside Colette and looking at the pictures with her. It was a pleasant first visit, and it lasted 3 hours. The two met again the next month, and Colette gave Matrona a Bible. She suggested reading the Bible together over the phone, but when she called, Matrona made herself unavailable to talk. Then Matrona moved to a facility in Anchorage. She was lonely and missed her friends in Fairbanks. She began to call Colette every day, trying to persuade her to adopt her. Colette, meanwhile, started the process of changing jobs. Her work as a pediatrician in Anchorage was ending, and she was preparing to move to Bethel, the largest community in western Alaska, with a population of 6,000. She would work at a hospital there. "Ew," Matrona said when she learnt about the move. To her, Bethel was a small village, and she thought it would be boring. This mission story offers an inside look at previous 13th Sabbath Project. Pediatrician Colette Real is also co-leader of Bethel, Alaska Seventh-day Adventist Church, which received part of the 2024 13th Sabbath offering. Thank you for helping spread the gospel with this quarter's 13th Sabbath offering on March 29. We will read more about Colette and Matrona next week.
And remember, God is always faithful.